So we're here speaking with Bill Buxton, principal researcher at MSR, and that's got to be one of the coolest jobs on the planet, right?
Yeah, it's the best one I could ever find.
So what's it like being at MSR? You just come up with anything you dream up.
Well, kind of. You know, your marching orders are really to make a difference and do original work, and also to think far out. The reality is that all of these things that we're seeing today, the seeds of them were planted up to 20 years ago, and it's what I call the long nose of innovation. And in some sense, you could think of if it takes 20 years to go from some invention to being a billion-dollar industry.
Yeah.
MSR is the sort of front third of the nose. Things like office labs are in the middle, and the product groups are here at the base to actually do the product types when the hockey stick starts to go up in terms of revenue. And sometimes you fast track things, but like any other kind of investment, Microsoft has really a great commitment to having a balanced portfolio of the whole food chain of ideas. So things aren't going to necessarily come out of the labs tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But every once in a while, we get these nice surprises. But you see things like Surface and other things that are already emerging, and it's great because you have this fantastic ecosystem and in-house, and it's unique in the world, actually.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of a lag when you do R&D, you know, for the benefits and the monetization to catch up with the work. But MSR, it's really the core of our mojo at Microsoft now. There's a lot of stuff starting to come out that are making changes.
Well, I guess it was last year was the 15th anniversary, so that says that now's the time where it's going to start really pumping out, because you start to reap the investment of the last 15 years. I mean, we've already done so in the past, but I mean, just to put some perspective on that, my group was doing multi-touch in 1984.
Old is new again.
And this is really important. And people say, well, aren't you bugged that it's just coming out now? I says, well, no, actually, well, I'm frustrated. That's my job. But the fact is that it typically takes how long. The mouse took 30 years from the time it was invented in 65 until it became ubiquitous with the release of Windows 95. And it had been around before, just like multi-touch had been around. But it sort of hits the tipping point and starts to take off. And so some of the stuff we do at MSR is not just technology and inventions and stuff like that, but it's actually looking at the process and trying to understand the ecosystem, and in particular, people and organizational structures. So there's sociologists and ethnographers and so on as well. Every part, again, of the ecosystem that creates this techno-impregnated world that we live in. And how do you tune it so you can actually optimize your ability to take advantage?
And it seems like we're coming up to kind of a perfect storm of opportunities where we have high-resolution displays, we have good battery life, we've got processors that are catching up to the really hardcore software ideas that we've had in the past. So there's a good convergence of opportunity in both the hardware and the ideas that we've got now, right?
No, I think that's largely correct. I look at it this way. It's sort of like, now that we can do anything, what should we do?
Yeah.
You know, and how do you make a business of it? And you can make a business of it and be doing the right thing. And how do you look in the world today and actually do things that we're proud of? Mm-hmm. Not just that we're making money, but this is thing. We have, the technologies that we're involved in at Microsoft are some of the most important cultural artifacts that are affecting how the world we live in evolves. I mean, obviously I'm not trying to make it overly grandiose or something like that.
Yeah.
But there's an opportunity, there's a privilege, but there's a responsibility, and there's also just the pleasure of being able to do it. But it also says, boy, with that, it's sort of like Spider-Man, you know, that great that great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah.
And then we get to do it.
Yeah.
And we get to live it. And so we're really lucky, just all of us. And the neat thing is that MSR can't do it on its own. You know, any of the product groups can't do it on its own. And the most interesting thing to me about Microsoft and why I came here and refused to even interview anywhere else was that all of the pieces of the puzzle were here. Now, they weren't necessarily all online and stuff like that, but the potential in that, and there was the opportunity to actually come and help shape it. And what else could you ask for in your career?
Yeah, you know? Definitely.
And so, no, it's really exciting.
So your background is in music. You have a degree in music.
Yeah.
What was the path from music to human-computer interaction? I guess it's kind of very similar.
Well, I have a couple ways to say that. First of all, I started playing synthesizers very early.
Yeah.
And somebody, here's the honest answer. my stepbrother was a guy in computers, and this is in 1971. And he said, oh, you should go look at computers and stuff like that. I said, well, what do I want to do that for? Who cares? I've never seen a computer, yeah. You know. And then he said, well, I'll loan you my motorcycle. I had this BMW, you know, R69S motorcycle. And there's a computer music, there's a computer system up north of where I was at university in Kingston, Ontario, up at Ottawa. It's about an hour's drive or so. And I got a chance to go up there and use it. And said, you can use my motorcycle. So I did it just for the motorcycle. So
yeah,
I drove up
there.
And then I saw this thing. This is 1971. And this system had a color display. It had real music notation. It had a piano keyboard you could play on. It had real-time
sounds. And what system was that?
It was a research system that nobody's heard of. It had a mouse, for pity's sakes. Not this 1971.
Boy.
They'd had a mouse since 1969. Xerox PARC didn't get one until 74.
Yeah.
And so I went and I did a film soundtrack for the small documentary film, and I just, in over a week, and I just fell in love. And I said, holy, this is... But it was about the motorcycle. And then I started to figure out, well, I don't want this just for in the studio. I want to start making performance instruments because I was a performer. I loved it. I played rock and roll bands and jazz groups. And so this is where multi-touch from my side of the space came from, was that I wasn't trying to make some computer interface. I was making a drum.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to make something where you could hit and drag your hand across and just use the natural gestures. Now, what it turns out is that musical performance was one of the best preparations to do what's now being called NUI and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Because I think there's no profession that has a longer history of expressing powerful ideas through a technological intermediary than music.
Yeah.
And so
you also have to have that real-time feedback.
Absolutely. The spots. You look at somebody who picks up a beautiful guitar or instrument, and before they play a note, you can tell from the smile on their face and just how they caress it, the quality and the respect built into the instrument for that person's skills. And my sense is that's the notion, is that I want to build products at Microsoft where just by looking at them, by touching them, it's not the superficial gloss of, you know, styling, but from everything you have to do with it, you just say, wow, the person who built this has paid, they care about me.
They have a respect for the interface, yeah.
And so I'd like to pretend that I was in the musical terms, the luthier. It used to be the luthier was the French word for the lute builder, but has generally become the instrument builder.
Yeah.
So I think about these things as the same care you would do into the most beautiful quality instruments. And they have to play well. They draw the best out of you. And they just fit, and they're just there, and you can just tell, and it's just great, and that's what drove me into this stuff, and then I got involved at some folks from Xerox PARC. Alan Kay came up, saw my stuff, and just said, "Wow, you know, this stuff's kind of cool, and it's relevant to other things." So I went down to PARC for a while. They came up, things took a bit of a shift. And in '89, I stopped playing professionally, and just said, I'd had a pretty successful career in music. So I said, what else is there? And I want to chase this. This captured my imagination.
Yeah. So there's a word that's floating around Microsoft a lot more recently, NUI. And for people who haven't heard this before, explain, what is NUI to you?
Well, so the first thing is that the term is called a natural user interface. That's what it comes from. This is the acronym. And, you know, the term has a... I have my... you know, I flip back and
love
forth
hate.
About it. Well, no, it's just because, so you will find a superficial description of it, it's touch, it's gesture, it's voice.
Yeah.
But that's not what it is. Those are really important components. But for me, what this is, and you can call it new user interface or whatever, but I'm happy with natural in a sense, as long as we define what constitutes natural.
Yeah.
And the notion is that the biggest change of technology is not the hardware or software. Yes, things are faster, smaller, and cheaper, and there's more of them. The thing that's really changed and is changing really rapidly now is who is doing what, where, with whom, for how much, and how.
How are they doing it?
And so, if you think about it, the history of computation, the von Neumann architecture that makes up the processors hasn't changed that much. The graphical user interface, in many ways, hasn't changed that much since the 70s. You know, Fritz Van Winkle went to sleep back in 1984 and woke up now. They would be recognizable the same way our cars are recognizable, even though the technology has changed. But the real thing is that It went from people in lab coats in hermetically sealed buildings at computer centers into computer rooms, into tethered things with time sharing, into PCs, but were still plugged in and anchored, into laptops, which were sort of portable desktop computers. And now, you know, is a GPS a computer? Is my Avalanche beacon a computer? Is my mobile phone a computer? It's just, the forms are just diverse. So the technology is ubiquitous. And furthermore, it's in things that are small, embedded, and portable, like our watches, up to things, but it's also embedded in the environment that's stationary, that's not ours. And then we have relationships with these things. How do we deal with that? So, and the most important thing is not only is this diversity of what I call the society of appliances, they're in these different locations. And place has meaning. Like if I just come up to you, our relationship just changed, right?
Yes.
And the same in principle should be true with our devices, mm-hmm. right? That how do relationships change by location? And it's all about real estate in cyberspace, if you want. It's location, location, location.
So if there's a display on the wall some distance across from you, you might use that for pictures or weather. Yeah. But if you walk up to it, your interface with that has changed. Yeah. They should know that you want to use it now.
Yeah, or where you are. And what's interesting is that there's these, it's like in the earlier days, these satellites, and it's called remote sensing, where they sense the ecosystem of the Earth and tell us about water, heat, forest fires, all this sort of stuff, pollution. The transducers that we have today are much closer. It's the same thing, though. It's what I call proximal sensing. It's a little bit like what the buzzwords are, things like sensor networks and so on and so forth, and ambient intelligence. But the real thing is that the cameras, the microphones, and other things. So just if you think about this wall-sized display, think about something like Natal, which is being developed for video games, being that type of technology being there, so it knows how close I am, knows I'm approaching. Mm-hmm. When I'm away, I can gesture with my hand, so when I come up, it realizes I'm right there, and so it switches over to sense my touch. And also, the fonts maybe get bigger as I get closer. Smaller as I get closer, bigger as I depart. And is there one person or two? And I'm not trying to make these things be like artificial intelligence and sort of stuff in the sense. I just want them to be consistent with my expectations.
It should be smart enough, though, that it knows, Natal will know each user.
Yeah.
So if I have a different eyesight, maybe my fonts are bigger at a distance than someone younger than me.
Right. But what I need to say about this and all of this, and so our repertoire, we're just like painters. We can paint these technologies. We can paint different visions of the future. We should always use the word future in the plural because there's more than one possible future. Which one do we choose? And if we enumerate the others, we can make maybe more intelligent choices. But the principal thing is, voice, gesture, touch does not necessarily natural user interface make. And I'll give you one example. Let's take speech. Make something I can just talk to my computer, get everything happening. If you're driving a vehicle and you're using any digital device that is not 100% eyes-free and hands-free and absolutely minimal cognition-free, so that you have absolutely minimal distraction from your primary task of driving, which probably means something that's completely speech operated. Mm-hmm. If you don't have that, you should be arrested. I don't want my kids playing the street with you driving.
Yeah.
And that's going to be legislated across all the jurisdictions going forward. So it is absolutely clear that for that task, if you are going to use it, and to the extent that it can be done safely, this is the natural and the correct way. And it's natural in the sense that it exploits skills that we have acquired through a lifetime of living in the world.
Yeah.
Which minimizes the cognitive load and therefore minimizes the distraction. So it's more like speaking to you when you're on the seat beside me in the car where my phone's sitting. Take exactly the same phone. Exactly the same thing I'm talking about in terms of a memo or a thought or something like that. And now I'm sitting in an airplane flying into San Jose Airport, and the thing I was talking about was the technical specifications of Natal. Using that same interface that I should be locked up in jail if I don't use in the car, I should be fired for using it in the plane because the person beside me is from a competitor and around me, right? And so the notion that speech, you can't say that something's best and just the thing or this is that.
So
without specifying the context.
Yeah, you have a saying, everything is best for something and worse for something.
That's exactly right. And then the good designer understands what, why, and for whom, and when. And what are the boundaries? And when somebody comes up and proposes an idea, a new technology, a new device, a new kind of gesture, and so on and so forth, for me, and they can give me all, really articulate really well all the great things that can be done, why it's the right thing to do. If they can't tell me with the same fluency what's wrong with it when it won't work, then I'm going to ask them to, let's dive into this conversation about, until you can do both,
yeah,
you haven't done your homework.
Yeah.
It's not ready. It's a good idea, maybe. I'm not saying you're right or wrong, but we don't understand it yet. And then we can start to make more intelligent decisions. So since we have some of these things we carry with us, and there's these things about it, and they need to adapt to our purpose, one size does not fit all. And so what we need is a palette so that with that same mobile device or portable or slate or whatever, that I can adapt to it seamlessly in a way that doesn't add more complexity, in a way that's appropriate for the context and the task and where I'm at. It's just like when you and I are talking. Sometimes if we're in a restaurant or something, we're going to speak quietly. Other times I'm just going to use hand gestures, and we can switch. Right? And sometimes I can pass you a note. And I could do all of those things in the same meeting, depending on the message.
So and, we might be in a meeting together, and I want to pass you a note that no one else sees and use some interface for
Or you
that.
Might speak to me out loud, or you might do that. And you realize that, oh, there's all these different channels. And if you don't have them all there, in that case, you're in the same context, but there's a different meaning or type of message. But there's other contexts. But that plurality of finding the appropriate. In some sense, it's maybe that's the better term, it's the appropriate user interface.
Yeah.
Because that implies the sense of context. But if we don't have it, the conversation's broken. The natural part of it is, it's natural that we converse in the appropriate way.
Mm-hmm.
And then, how do we support the richness of that? And that's why, actually, at Microsoft Research, we have, there's a group, one of my favorite groups in Cambridge, England, that I work with the most. You've got a bunch of, high-end engineer researchers and so on, but the managers are a sociologist and a cognitive psychologist. And there's ethnographers and designers in there. And we have these sort of wacko, heterogeneous, we talk about heterogeneous computer networks, but I got to tell you, heterogeneous social networks are way cooler.
Yeah.
Because you get these collections of people. And so, the Renaissance is over. There's no such thing as, the world's too complex for any single person to know everything. But, the king's dead, long live the king. The Renaissance is over, long live the Renaissance. Renaissance team. And that's one of the things that's most interesting about where we are. So we have one of the only places in the world where you have these really interesting collections of people, of skills, that bring these really diverse backgrounds and perspectives to addressing these problems. So I think we've got a chance of getting it right. And man, if we do, just think what the consequences are.
So one of the futures that I expect you might see is that we will kind of flow between the traditional GUI and the more natural user interfaces, kind of like we go from a computer to getting on a phone back to a computer. So you're moving between these different types of interfaces?
Okay, so let's deconstruct that, because that's a really nice question, and it really helps explain it. I would argue that if I'm writing, I write a column for Business Week just on design and innovation, okay? If I'm doing that, I think the GUI is the natural interface.
Yeah.
Right? For that thing. It's just not the natural thing for me when I'm in my car.
Yeah.
Right? And so so what we've had in the past is for some things, what we've been doing have already, I'm not one of these people who says I want to get rid of the keyboard and the mouse and Windows. I think there is a place. And that the new things don't replace, and we always view things in a competitive sense.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about it, cinema didn't replace live theater.
Yeah.
Television didn't replace cinema. Games didn't replace television. And videotapes and other things, DVDs and so on, didn't replace that. They all have their niche.
Yeah.
And radio still exists. And so it's a question, though, you refine and get to a finer granularity of covering the space so that you, and we start to understand in the McLuhan-esque sense that the medium's the message, but each medium has its own attributes and properties.
Yeah.
And then as we get more literate and understanding this world that's emerging, we become literacy sort of means knowing what's the right tool. It's sort of like the difference between we've got a screwdriver and a hammer. Now refining sort of slot head screwdrivers to different sizes. And then we've got Phillips and Robertson and all these and hex screwdrivers and stuff like that. And somebody who's right, and so we start, and I'm not trying to say we want to have this, we populate the space with this, you know, humongous mess of stuff.
Yeah.
What it is that what is the critical thing with design is what's the minimal subset that gives us the best coverage? What's the best compromise? Because the thing about computers is that you don't need a gazillion different screwdrivers because they can morph.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can have a reason, so you don't have to live like you're in a percussion studio. You have this minimal set, but of things that just flow and blend. And where you get the power is through the combinatorics. And this comes back that when I walk up here, pretend I wanted to show you something, why would I show it to you on, I've got my mobile phone, in fact, I have it in my pocket, so I pull it out, but why would I show it to you on this little screen when I could just go point it there, do a gesture, bingo, and then up it comes, and then I can use touch here as I would use the touchpad on my laptop and pretend that's a screen. We could have that kind
of
function.
That would be very cool.
Right? And I walk away, and by the way, you stay, well, within Microsoft, you realize that means the networking people have some really hard work to do.
Yes,
that means
definitely.
The security people have some really hard work to do.
Yeah, so the handshake with any screen that you walk
into
is
in a secure way that stuff's not being ripped off and cookies aren't being loaded and stuff like that. And you realize that you think about it at the surface that this new stuff just affects the UX, user experience people.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, there's not a part of this company that doesn't have to be on point and focus towards this end, because there's this really interesting engineering infrastructure. You know, and so, you know, there's a reason I have a graduate degree in computer science as well as music, because you need to know this technical stuff as well as the designer. What's visible is sort of the, you know, the artsy-fartsy, you know, I'm not dressed in black, but, you know, it's pretend I am, type of the design side. But there's hardcore engineering that has to be done here. And again, that's why this is a great place to do it. But if we get it right, the critical thing is the tail of technology should not be wagging the dog of the human and society.
Absolutely, yeah.
But if you want, I think about the technology as a prosthesis. And you have to be a really good engineer to make a good prosthetic, but you also have to know about the person, whether it's a social prosthetic, that's what social computing is in a sense. It extends our ability to on a motor sensory prosthetic, like an input device, or a cognitive prosthetic, which is things that are systems that start to react and do reasonable things. Get that all right, we got a good future.
So I think one of the things that the average consumer wouldn't have really gotten about Microsoft is that, especially with Natal, we have NUI baked into almost all of our major products. I mean, we have multi-touch in Windows 7, we have the Ford Sync, we'll have Natal. There's a lot of this is already into our products. So where people might think that it's new, it's been going on for a long time. We've always had you know speech in the tablet PC and a lot of other newy things that are just really starting to be a big part of our software.
So the first thing is things don't happen generally in a big bang where you just turn a switch and it comes. And it's a little bit like your kids. If you don't mark their heights on the kitchen cupboard door, you don't notice how much they've developed and changed in the last year, right? So you have these, you have to...
Until one day they're eye level.
Right? And all of a sudden you say, holy cow, what,
what happened?
That was last year, this year. You write the date every time on their birthday or something like that. Example, in some sense you could say that the tablet PC, in retrospect, was our first offering in surface computing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we realize these, and it's often you have to be down the path a bit before you start to see the patterns and the trends that are and the convergences. So, we look on other things. For me, let's take an example of multi-touch. It started off on Surface, and then it migrates over to Win 7, and then last year we had this wonderful thing where all of a sudden it starts getting support in Silverlight, and so even on thin clients working on the cloud. So you start to be able to, as we start to populate the space, the pattern, and by the way, recognize that took how many different parts of the company, MSRs, where the multi-touch started and company, and then you go into the Surface group, you go into the Windows group, you go into Live Labs, which I brought some of the stuff and the .NET team and Expression Blend, and all these different groups, all, that's different divisions of the company, different presidents in many cases. What seemed like a bunch of discrete products, all of a sudden, oh, there's a pattern there. This actually is a strategy.
Yeah.
There actually is a plan. It actually is executing. And the pieces of the puzzle are coming together. We're on the threshold now of reaching critical mass where we start to reap the benefits of that investment that actually has been going on for a number of years.
Mm-hmm. So with the keyboard and mouse interface, you know, there's a time investment that a power user can make to get really fast with it by using keyboard shortcuts and other things like that. Is there the same type of investment with natural user interfaces, or is the emphasis on natural?
Okay, so here we come down to, again, the types of things, what's natural. The only things that are really natural are the things that are innate that we're born with. We can hear, we can walk, we have to eat, we breathe, and so on and so forth. Those are innate attributes. Then there's a couple other attributes which are things like we also have an innate ability to learn and to be curious and build up skills. So the reason you have power users is because they've invested in developing a particular skill.
Yeah.
What's important to understand is the nature of skill. Skill is really expensive to acquire. Things which seem natural and simple to us today, things as simple as tying a shoelace, if you look back or if you have young kids, you realize that isn't natural. It's a very unnatural thing, and people struggled with a long time to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But once you've made that investment, if that skill that you invested in can be used for something else, why would you not use that? And why would you make somebody learn something new, which is just as hard, which you could have done with less? So, don't waste people's skill. They're really expensive to acquire.
Yeah.
Right? And we're already too busy. It's not that I don't like learning. It's just that there's already too much to learn, and I still aren't going to catch up. Yeah. Lifetime of learning notwithstanding. So, in the sense that things are natural, is how do you design in a way that can take advantage of the skills that you have already acquired from a lifetime of living in the everyday world? And when I say skills, I mean motor sensory skills, I mean cognitive skills, I mean social skills. And if you think about the technology, and this is maybe the best way to think about it, as a mirror, you can evaluate the quality of the design by the fidelity with which that mirror reflects you. And that sounds, that's kind of a nice metaphor, but it doesn't quite make it. So I'll refine it. And so what does that mean? So how does a mirror, how I see, how I touch, how I move, how I, and my motor sensory, how I hear, how I speak, the motor sensory part, how does it reflect my cognitive side, how I learn, how I problem solve, how I feel emotionally? And fourth, my social skills. How does the technology reflect those skills that I've already acquired? And then how I behave and what are the standard conventions in different circumstances? Get the fidelity of all three mirrors. And the fourth one could be your emotional skills. But if we've got that fidelity in all four mirrors, I think you qualify for doing NUI. It doesn't come for free just because you got a particular technology. You need the whole deal. Now, to answer your question, one of the key things is whenever possible to not force you to learn something new, but to do the design in a way that exploits a skill you already have. For example, simple thing I'd love to see, on the scroll arrows when you're scrolling up and down, I'm used to driving a car, so the harder I push the pedal, the faster things go, right?
Sure.
That's called stimulus response compatibility. I have that. I got a pressure-sensitive stylus. I could have a pressure-sensitive button on the mouse. The harder I push, the faster it scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I don't have to learn anything. I just tell you that, and you'll remember it forever, and you'll know how to use it, right?
Yeah.
Because you've got the skill built in.
Yeah.
There's lots of places like that. Now, there are some places, like touch typing, or playing the violin, which takes 13 years of practice, which makes typing, learning to type, seem like nothing, right? Where if the value is there, it's worth learning something new. Because again, typing on a QWERTY keyboard, no, it is not a natural thing, but neither is driving a car, neither is learning to put on shoes, neither is tying a shoelace, neither is knowing how to work an elevator. We live in a society, intelligence is defined by the ability to adapt to the changes in the ecosystem through accommodation and assimilation. And so we just design things which are intelligent and that utilize human intelligence, but don't waste the investment they've already made in skills. But when necessary, you bring in new skills. But the way you get up to speed fast is just because it's a power law. It's called the power law of practice. We have to be, that's part of the respect. I respect the time you've spent learning to play violin, so I'm going to build you the most damn violin that'll make you sound, for the amount of investment you've made, you sound better as than you ever imagined and as good as it's possible to let you
get the most sound from your abilities.
Absolutely.
With the hardware, yeah.
It's an amplifier. It's the prosthetic. And that's full of surprise and delight. I want you to be surprised and delighted in the way the violinist, wow, I've never sounded this good. What a beautiful instrument.
Yeah.
Wow, on my machine, on my mobile. You know, and if that's the measurement of success, right, the revenue will follow.
Yeah.
Right? It's just, but that's what we all dream about.
So with a Silverlight especially, I mean, it's now the web has the potential to be multi-touch.
Yeah.
And we're opening up these new interfaces to people who probably haven't thought of this before. What does someone like a web designer need to think about with natural user interfaces?
Yeah, I guess we tend to think about innovation in terms of products and the basic technologies. And I think that, again, that's a really good question because it brings it out a really easily neglected aspect of what we're at here. And that is that it's not enough to have the technologies, the end products, and so on and so forth. If you don't build the tools that help people do that, if you don't have the good examples, if you don't put in place things like mix and other things where you do this, you basically, they're educational seminars to help bring our partners up to speed. That's how we grow, right? Is by having our partners grow. But that's too arrogant. That assumes we know and they don't.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
The other part is that we spend time, and that's why you go to things like Mix and the Worldwide Partners Conference and other things where we engage with customers, because I don't just go to a talk and then disappear. I hang out because I want to hear what people are, what the input, because it's a bi-directional medium.
Yeah, you learn from their experimentation.
Absolutely. That's, how arrogant to believe that we know more about web design than the world's best web designers who actually buy our products, right?
Yeah.
It's just, it's absurd. We're not that stupid. So the question is, how do you build that ecosystem? But what I'm trying to say is that it's as important to invest in the design of the culture of the ecosystem that's necessary to make this stuff come as it is to design where we're trying, where we're going. The transitions are as important and take as much attention as the thing you're going to.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes just thinking about the business model. It includes, it's the same thing as, like, I have the greatest product, but if I don't have a business plan or marketing plan, how am I going to get there? And that's true with the marketing of ideas, of aesthetics, of ways of working, as well as with products. And I'd say that research is actually engaged in all those things. And not only research, but the company is.
So at PDC in the Coding for Fun booth, they had some very interesting examples of user interface that included some augmented reality.
Yep.
How important is augmented reality to an effective natural interface?
So there's some interesting technologies around that. And I think that, so I've been involved in that space from pretty much the beginning of AR. And I think it's a way to augment the physical world with virtual. So for people to understand, it's sort of like if instead of this virtual reality where it's a totally synthetic world, if I'm navigating through space, you see the physical world, but then I actually get metadata. It could just be labels superimposed on the real world, sort of like a heads-up display.
Yeah.
Well, in the past, it's been these things. We have backpacks and all this complex gear. But what if your mobile phone just has a little Pico projector in it, and you don't need all this tracker? You just point it at a device or something, and either through RFID tagging or other ways of tagging or knowing where it is, you press the projector and it's like a flashlight and it illuminates the thing you're looking at. But it illuminates it with information, not just with light. Light is the vehicle to provide the information. And I don't need all this tracking because I can just point it and register it myself with my hand. And all of a sudden I've got a really cheap thing with me all the time and all of a sudden it becomes different. And by the way, if I've got a camera in that mobile phone that's flashing it out, I can then, that's also a touch screen.
Yeah.
Think of it this way. A mobile phone, what's surface? Surface is a projector and camera in alignment that rear project onto a rear projection screen, and then I can sense touch and plus see the display. If I turn it upside down and just go like this with the same thing, my mobile phone is surface. Mm-hmm. Now, instead of going onto a plain virgin rear projection screen surface, I project it onto that mouse. It can start to, the projection can say, oh, that's a mouse. It can do that. I can align it. And then the labels are all there for how to use it. The manual's right there.
Yeah.
Right? And then I close it and turn off. And that's within the technological reality of the next 12 months to do. That's not a product announcement. I'm just,
sure,
but
yeah.
Because we can go on like this forever.
Yeah.
There's so many different things we can do, so many different scenarios. The question is then, and this is where the discipline comes in, having great ideas is not the problem. Great ideas are a dime a dozen.
Sure.
Out of the 100, picking the two, they're the ones you should be doing at this stage of the game, and figuring out how they fit into the larger puzzle. That's where leadership and
yeah, that seems like that would be one of the hardest problems. Is there's a lot of good paths to go down,
that's
but
right.
Which ones and when?
Let's come back to what I said earlier. Always talk about the word future, like math, as maths or mathematics in the plural. To confront yourself all the time, to remind yourself all the time that there's more than one future. Which one do you want? Why? And then, once you've made that decision and you've got a good rationale, it makes it easier to prune the tree. And it doesn't mean you're not going to do those other things. It's just a question of how do you prioritize. And you'd like it to be not by some short-term economic thing that takes you down a blind alley, but rather in something that fits into your long-term strategy. And that's that helps integrate all of the disparate products of the company so that they actually start to be seen as part of a suite of things, that each one has great value on its own, but far more value even, or greater value, when it's in combination with some of the others. But by the you get the diversity of all these different things by the combinatorics that can result by combining these things in different ways. And so instead of trying to build one device that does that, another device that does that, if I have the right set of things, that by combining these three things I've got, or in the different combinations I can cover, you know, the majority of the space.
Yeah.
With the minimum number, but the right number of the right devices and technologies. That's kind of the way I think we have to work it, or else it'll just be overwhelming because it's too complex. But again, that's kind of our job. If it wasn't hard, we shouldn't be here, right?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not worth doing. Or it would have been done already. And so we can't lash ourselves in the back too much for not having instant answers. The question is having interesting questions and interesting strategies and a way to work through them. And recognize that, you know, we're human, and we should never have to apologize for that. But we should also recognize that and then take the appropriate steps and precautions.
Well, thanks so much for coming and talking to us today.
It's
really
my pleasure.
It. Come back anytime.
I love to. I mean, it's clear. This stuff is just great. How can you not love it and be enthusiastic? We live in really interesting
times.
It's
a great time in technology.
I've been at it, as I said, from 1971, and it's better now than it has ever been.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.